Oh, that's right. We're right here this afternoon. What is it? 4:08 in the afternoon. The sun, it is a shining. It looks beautiful out there. And my very special guest this afternoon is Orville Vernon Burton, who is a professor of history at Clemson University and director of the Clemson Cyber Institute. Wow, those are big words there. How you doing today, Vernon?
Really well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you, as always.
Yeah, we had a great interview when you were here just about a year ago, I think it was.
I think so.
And we talked about a lot of the different books that you've written. You've just written a new book. What's the name of the new book?
It's Penn Center, A History Preserved.
Now, when I first saw that, I was like, Penn Center, what is that? And I had to do some research to find out what Penn Center is. What is Penn Center, for those that don't know?
Well, it's an amazing place, and you're not the only one. I had a very good friend who I gave his name as one of the probably leading public intellectuals of people you would know and think when I told him I had this book on Penn Center because of his own activities. I wondered, had he been there during the Civil Rights Movement? He thought I meant the University of Pennsylvania, but of course, Penn Center is off the coast of Beaufort, South Carolina. It is the island after Ladies Island, is St. Helena Island. And there, starting in 1862, was a school. You had primarily abolitionist women school teachers who came down with the intent of building schools and educating people who had been enslaved on that island. Now, I wrote in this book that these were some of the bravest women that I could imagine because they were behind enemy lines. And one of my thesis advisors, James McPherson, who, you know, wrote Battle Cry of Freedom, probably the most well-known and best book on the Civil War, although I do think The Age of Lincoln ranks right up there, if I'll be so immodest. But he said to
that
me,
was
Vernon,
book you wrote,
you
right,
got, that's
yeah,
right.
Okay.
Now remember, all proceeds from my books goes to gifted children, and I'll go with you to the IRS to argue my grandchildren the most gifted children in the world. And actually, the proceeds for the Penn Center book go to Penn Center. I'm not taking anything, trying to help the play. But I wanted to finish.
Why did you want to write this book?
They came to me.
They came to
they
you.
They came to me
okay.
and asked me to help. And I probably shouldn't have taken the time. It took me 4 years, which was way too much time. But I was going to mention behind enemy lines, what we don't realize, of course, this little area, these islands were captured by the Union. But, you know, they are surrounded by South Carolina, the Confederacy. So quite literally, Charlotte Fortin, who was an African-American woman there, if the Confederacy had captured, and there was hardly any forces to protect them there, had captured that area again, Charlotte Fortin would have been sold into slavery, and no telling what would have happened to these other women. So these were some of the most courageous women, Laura Townsend, and dedicated, who really had a Christian zeal to do what they thought God was telling them to do and to build the school. So Penn Center develops as a school. And finally, in the 1950s, I guess, it ceases to be a school. It always had trouble with funding. And it becomes a community service center and works. Today, it is best known for its Gullah culture and for its back to Africa and looking at African roots. There's a great museum there that continues to host a number of programs. And it works. It worked as a center on and on with all introducing all sorts of things. And it actually, what is interesting about Penn Center is almost an alternative history as we've normally been taught it in American history. It's seen off of this area which up until you had the bridges built and things, was very few whites on St. Helena Island. And so sort of from a black perspective, and then it was one of the few places during the age of segregation where blacks and whites could actually meet together. Martin Luther King Jr. held his retreats there. The citizenship schools, which many scholars say was the single most important sort of technique that was successful in the Civil Rights Movement, those schools were held at Penn Center. The Peace Corps did its training there. So you can go on and on and on even today. It's been an amazing place, and few people know about it.
Yeah, particularly in South Carolina. I'll bet it's better known outside of South Carolina, maybe, than in South Carolina.
By some groups, because so many people held their retreats there over the years and things.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. So by writing this book, one of the things that I was interested in, it says that you wrote this from the perspective of so many people. How did you go back and research people if this had been going on?
Well, I did a lot of oral history because you have so many people who are still alive who were from there. But there's a tremendous amount of records, and this just scratches the surface. There can be 25, 30 more books written on things that happened at Penn Center. It's just an amazing overtime. You can sort of trace out the history of African-American education. There, particularly the 19th century, people left diaries, they wrote letters, so you have all of those sorts of things. There's a lot of records from Clemson Extension Service who are working with the farmers on St. Helena Island. Health care comes out of Penn Center. Daycare, in fact, one of the ideas of daycare that was developed there, they actually took it to Africa as a program. So it's had world sort of influences that we are not very much aware of here. The exciting period is the Civil Rights Movement. I think everybody who was anybody in the Civil Rights Movement came through Penn Center, were involved there in amazing ways. And if people go there, they should ask to see the King Cabin. I had it. I just saw the book for the first time last week at a conference, and I just looked. They messed up my dedication, which bothers me, and also a map that I have there, and I had a map drawn to the King Cottage. King was able to relax there, Martin Luther King Jr., and he loved it. It was a way he could get away from stress. He could be himself. There's some great pictures. It has 42 pictures, which is amazing, I think, for a press to put that many in. Some of him singing with Joan Baez and relaxing. And he liked it so much, they built a cottage for him down in the marsh. And he was coming back, but he never made it back. I was just in Memphis last week. In fact, until yesterday, and of course, that was where he was killed. He left Penn Center, went out to Memphis, and was killed. So he never got to see the cottage that was built for him. It's still called the King Cottage, a retreat place for King when he came to Penn Center.
Wow. That is a lot of history. A lot of stuff that's
and our own Ben Mays from Greenwood County here in 96. My personal hero was very involved in Penn Center and very involved in the transition. Penn Center was controlled by Northerners, or as we like to say here in the South, by the Yankees.
Why was it controlled by Northerners?
Well, they're the ones who came down to, and I hate to put it in these crass terms, but they were going to, quote, civilize and educate African Americans. I don't want to make them sound bad because it's very complicated, and these were wonderful people. Many of these white women who were there in particular spent their entire lives there as teachers and nurses and doing things. But in their mind, in their image, they were Americanizing, making citizens of, and bringing education to a more backward people. What is interesting, at a critical time, Ben Mays is one of the first African Americans who gets on the board of Penn Center, and you begin to get some white Southerners like James McBride's dad, Marion Wright, Marion Wright's from Edgefield, incidentally, Alice Spearman. And these are people who are, the latter ones, Dr. Mays is African-American, the others are white that I'm mentioning. They really take a different take. And Martin Luther King's message was sort of this, and I think he probably got it from Dr. Mays. I haven't really traced it out. But they changed from white Northerners coming down to save African-Americans, the idea that African-Americans have been the true Christians, following Jesus's principles of peace and turn the cheek and following Christ around and say it is going to be African Americans who save the South, in particular the soul of white Southerners. So it takes a very different tone, particularly starting in the 1950s and 1960s when Southerners come in charge, both black and white, over time of Penn Center.
Interesting. Well, we're here with Vernon Burton. We're going to be talking about this. We're going to be talking, probably getting into a little voting rights. He's been doing some court work on that. We've got a lot of things to talk about, but it's going to be an interesting conversation, I'm sure. Always enjoy sitting down with Vernon Burton. Let's hear a quick word from our sponsors. And if you've got a question, give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984.
Gold, gold, more precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery. I was just getting Vernon some more water. He likes our water here. How you doing there, Vernon?
We've
been talking about your new book, Penn Center, A History Preserved. And so many people have been involved in it, and it really changed what really happened. And it also preserved so much of the history, and it's a place where the Gullah people are able to maintain their roots, I guess we could say.
That's right, and discover their roots in some cases. It's a very interesting history. Up until fairly recently, people were trying to get away from their Gullah culture, and they were taught, particularly in the schools, even at Penn, that you shouldn't be speaking Gullah, that you don't do Gullah, because that will hold you back from getting jobs you want to get. And so now that's sort of reversed. After they did the Gullah Bible, again, some people came in and did it, they discovered and sort of moved back to the idea of the heritage and how important this is. And of course, there's a Gullah Geechee Corridor that Congressman James Clyburn sponsored that runs, I think, from North Carolina to Florida. But Penn Center is really the true center of that. And if people get a chance, it's worth going to their museum and just seeing all that they have there. And it's an amazing story of Gullah and the language and the people, the culture, the quilting, the stories. All of these things are connected.
Quilters are very interesting, and how they used the quilts to give them symbols on escaping from the South and going North.
Right.
I mean, I've heard some of these stories with the quilters and everything. It's absolutely fascinating how they knew where to go and where was a safe haven and where wasn't
right.
a safe haven. All that is really, really interesting.
And of course, Robert Smalls, who's lately people have gotten to know, and I actually did my first paper when I was a grad student at Princeton on Robert Smalls. Now he's become much more famous, but he was the Gullah statesman and actually gave, he is the person who introduced the bill in the South Carolina legislature during Reconstruction in the first session that said we would have public schools. You know, South Carolina didn't have public schools before then, so it's actually a Gullah.
What did we have?
We didn't have any. Rich folks paid for tutors,
okay.
or schools are subscribed. So, and there was a big fight against it, of course, that why did people need education if they were farming? And, of course, it was only whites. There were a few freed African American, but that I've often thought, I don't want to go off too deep on a Southern history lecture, but one of the major differences between the South and the North was you can look in Massachusetts, they had the old delude Satan law.
Mm-hmm.
And what
the
you
Satan
had,
law.
Satan law, delude okay. Satan. And the reason it was, anytime you had 50 people household, you had to build a school because you had to teach people to read the Bible. Otherwise, Satan might trick them or delude them. And so you had this idea of education, but with enslaving people in the South and then not wanting them to be able to read and write, we took a different attitude toward education. Just for
That's
the upper class. It is,
yeah,
and I think it's
yeah.
made a huge difference. It's why, the great universities like Harvard, Princeton come out of this kind of tradition.
I've never heard that before.
Well,
yeah.
I think it's an Age of Lincoln, so I'm not
yeah.
sure. I may not have put it in, but I'd like to when I was teaching in Illinois to talk about how we develop cultures and how they perpetuate over time so you can get an idea of where you are and why you have the attitudes you do today. And then maybe by understanding how we got there to think, do we want to continue to go that way or do we want to change in some way?
One of the fascinating things about history, and I've got to admit, I thought that history was boring and, you know, a waste of time. Why did I want to know history and everything? But now doing the job that I do, and particularly when it comes down to politics and where our country is going and how it was shaped and everything, I wish I'd paid attention more in history and gotten more of a background in it.
Well, you know, and I was the same way. It was only when I went to Furman and my history professors, I didn't care. My best friend loved history. He's from Greenwood in 96. He now teaches math, of all things, at Francis Marion. And I was actually pretty good in math and interested in science. And I'm a historian, so we sort of traded roles. But I was the same way, and I only learned, in fact, later on, just how important our history is to us. It gives people a sense of power, of change, and understanding. It's not that history, it's fun to read about people and all. You hear all the cliche, but we are where we are now for a certain reason. And to understand that, you have to look and see how we got into the situation we are now and how it grows out of that. And I think that is the only way you can possibly change. Change is not easy.
No, it's not.
I mean, you're going to change for better or worse, but literally if you want to make major changes for betterment, I think you have to understand why people feel the way they do, think the way they do.
I think it's very apropos in war, though, isn't it?
Yes.
Because why a battle turned out this way, why this happened, you know, history repeating. Are you going to make the same mistakes again? And you see that a lot in battles and whatnot.
Right.
But we don't actually relate it so much to our everyday life.
And not to democracy and voting and education and how it's important to understand the issues. I would never tell anyone how to vote. I think people are perfectly, they have the right to their vote. They have a right to a secret ballot and to be able to vote. But you want them to understand why they're voting and why it's important and what happens with that vote, what differences it can make. We are a government of laws. I mean, I think the last time we talked a lot about Lincoln and the importance of laws, and I think he convinced me that, you know, it is important that we have laws, and although laws are slow to change, they can be changed in a democracy if you see them as unfair. It's like Penn Center was a center of getting segregation ended in not only South Carolina, but throughout the South, and certainly it was one of the impetus for getting people to be able to vote with a citizenship school where literacy was used as a way to keep people from voting, and with that, the changes that come. Now you have, again, a black congressman and a black senator from South Carolina, you know, so that was not, after Reconstruction ended, people thought it would never happen again.
Absolutely. We are talking with Vernon Burton this afternoon. We're talking about his newest book, The Penn Center, A Historical History Preserved. And, you know, that is one of the things, preserving history. But the problem is, if we don't spend the time being able to, you know, a good history teacher or professor is one that brings it to light for kids and does relate it to present as well as in the past, I believe. I can get real excited when I'm talking to somebody that makes it exciting and makes it alive. And for so many years, history was truly blah. And I think it's because when I was in college, I can remember having a class where you just go, well, shall I go to class or shall I skip it? I won't miss anything if I skip it, you know. And so I think that is the problem. But today, with the internet and with the videos and all this type of thing, it certainly has made, it has changed that aspect of it.
Yeah, in the History Channel, the documentaries, I'm sure people just saw the Ken Burns or at least knew about it, the Roosevelts.
That was a good one. I saw that.
And all of those are important. But I think they're beyond that. And one of the things that upsets me is that South Carolina has such a rich and wonderful history and complex. And this area does, that we can learn so much from. We can not only learn lessons from, but we can begin to understand why we do and act as we do and things. So, you know, I really encourage people to get involved with their history and to learn that the other thing I want to encourage people, history is an interpretation. We don't really know what people are doing. We work from the evidence and try to be honest, but it varies who's doing that history, what interpretation one will come up with.
Yeah, that's kind of like politics, isn't it? I'm here with Vernon Burton. We're going to hear South Carolina radio news. We'll be back. Don't you go away.
McDonald's presents Confessions of an Ex-Hipster.
I loved cappuccinos, so I put on an itchy turtleneck and grew a goatee. But before I knew it, I was into French films, indie rock, and not bathing. Luckily, I got help from McDonald's McCafé cappuccinos. Now I'm watching football, wearing khakis, even high-fiving again. Thank you, McDonald's.
New McCafé mochas, lattes, and cappuccinos from McDonald's. With fresh ground espresso and real steamed milk, it's all the coffee, hold the attitude. At participating McDonald's.
Visit your local McDonald's in Greenwood and Abbeville today.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery, talking with Vernon Burton. I tell you what, we're bouncing all over, talking about all the different aspects that Vernon has been involved in. And one of the things that you've been involved in recently is you've been a witness on these voting ID laws.
That's right.
And what has that been the basis on that? You've been to Texas. I remember a couple of times we had interviews scheduled had to change. What's that all about?
From Texas about 2 weeks ago, testifying in the voter ID case, and I was the expert witness in South Carolina against the voter ID here that we have.
Why should we not have voter ID?
Well, we do have voter ID. We have voter ID with registration cards and other things. I guess the question is, why do we want to change it when no one can document any in-person voter fraud? But there's a lot of the voting fraud that exists tends to exist in the absentee ballots. So what it has become, it's become a way of vote denial. And the people, for instance, I was the expert witness for the League of Women Voters here in South Carolina. And the people who are least likely to have the required voter ID are students and elderly and, of course, minorities. And that's how the Voting Rights Act gets involved. And that's one of my areas of specialty. So I testify about these vote denial or write reports and testify about them.
So basically what you're saying is there is no reason to deny the vote, and what they should be more worried about is the absentee ballot.
Well if you think there are problems, no one has been able to document hardly any. I mean, minuscule, sure, one or two places. Someone's daughter voted for the mother or something like that. But the laws that exist are you'd have to be pretty crazy to want to go in person and try to vote and claim you're somebody you are not. There are a lot of reasons for that. We have time, we can go into them, including most places like 96, people know you, and you're voting in your precinct,
right,
and area. The other thing is the types of IDs, photo IDs, that are required. For instance, Texas, you can use a handgun permit, but you can't use the state of Texas if you work for the state of Texas, or a student ID, even if it's a public university like the University of Texas. And the reasons are pretty, the correlations are so strong. The people who have handguns pretty much are white, and or the permits, and you have a lot of minorities who are students, or of course students in general. It all boils down to people trying to figure out how to stay or to get in political power, and how, in fact, or who votes in those groups. So unfortunately, it's taken on that sort of dimension. And particularly unfortunate, it has taken on the dimension of minorities, which is an old story in America. I don't think people are necessarily who doing this are doing it for racist reasons. I think they're doing it for political reasons, but you cannot separate race and politics, partisan politics in the South, because not all, but the great majority of African Americans are voting for the Democratic Party. And so I think that is how you get into it. It's a very complicated story. But for someone like me who believes in democracy, I think we want everybody to vote. Others disagree with this, but I think it's, we've worked hard to expand from property owners to all adult white males to basically 18 and over now.
Now, that brings up another question, because I brought up to you earlier when we were off the air, well, what about all the immigrants in our country, and how would we control the vote? If everybody could just walk in and vote, how would we control the vote? And you brought up a very interesting point, one that I really hadn't thought about, and that was that how many immigrants did we have back in the day?
Yeah, well, America's a country of immigrants. So almost all of the vote denial are vote dilutive techniques that the South is rather famous for and the Voting Rights Act covers were actually developed in the North, not against African Americans, but against, of course, the Italians and the Irish and the Polish, and trying to find ways to keep them from getting into political power. This is why we need to study, you know, government and democracy. It's about political power and who's in power. And, you know, I've tried to say to people, it doesn't matter if it's Democrats, Republicans, or Martians in control of the government. Unfortunately, it has been, you know, minorities who are literally sort of denied the vote, or in some way their vote diluted so they have less of a meaningful vote. There are a lot of reasons behind that.
Or a political group goes after that minority vote, promises them the moon, and then really can't deliver.
Well, that's right. Most politicians don't deliver. Well, it's very interesting in Texas, because I really do think that the Republican Party is not being very smart, because I think a lot of Hispanic, and there's a difference between illegal immigrants and immigrants, of course, right. But I think a lot of Hispanic citizens might more naturally vote Republican, but they're so angry over what is clearly being seen as, right. And, you know, I can show you statements to that effect, you know, of what's really behind the pretense of voter fraud. And it's interesting, you know, the thing of voter fraud is the exact pretext or pretense that has been used in American history for almost every device that limits the ability of people to vote. And that's the excuse given. But then when the courts have looked at it, they come back and say that the real reason has been to deny the vote or keep people from having a meaningful vote over time. And it's the same one. You've got to be suspicious if they're still saying the same thing now they were saying in 1876. And then again with the poll tax in the 1940s and 1962 and 64 and the re-registrations. So it's an interesting story, and one we need to know more about. We need to understand. Again, I don't want to tell anyone how to vote. I think that, in fact, is anyone's business. But you need to know the implications of what you're doing. It seems to me people are not thinking in the long term. They're thinking in short term how they can keep themselves in control politically.
You're right. And I think one of the other things that is a problem in today's world particularly is the media. Because depending on which news source or which one you subscribe to, it depends on the slant that you're going to get out of it. The other thing is, how many people vote just for name recognition? They don't vote because they know anything about the candidate. Maybe the candidate, the one that was serving, was someone that they really admired. Now they're out because they've retired or whatever. Their daughter, their son has taken over. Maybe they are not very good at what they do, but they have name recognition, so I'll vote for this one.
And I think you're exactly right on the media, and I'll get back to it. You know, I love Lincoln and the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And we've gone to, you know, 15-second sound bites and things, as opposed to someone giving an hour and a half
statement.
And the other one given another hour, and then the other another. So you have 3-hour debates on real issues of democracy, as opposed to this sort of smearing people on both sides, and coming, and often, you know, without much basis, but trying to find out from polls what people don't like, then associating those people with those things.
Well, and the debates we have today, whether it's a presidential debate or a senator or whatever, they're 60 seconds,
that's
two
right.
minutes.
That's
what
right.
can you learn about the person in that?
That's right. Better than nothing, but I agree, and I think it's important. Most of these people have written things. People need to study. Again, I can't imagine anything more critical than understanding how government works in democracy. As I said, you know, Lincoln understood that democracy doesn't stand still. It can go backwards or forwards. And I think we're living in some interesting times in terms of what could happen when we have, you know, the Congress so blocked. But I was going to say what you said about the media. You know, you can go now and find anything you want. You can think, and you'll find somebody who agrees with you
exactly.
that you think of that makes some authority because it's written on the web or said on the web, and that's not the case. I mean,
well, if it's on the web, it's the truth,
right.
isn't it?
And we're very bad about that. I work with my students to try to teach them to be critical of even anything I say. One of the things I've always done in teaching and say, show how I'm wrong on some argument I've made against your professor, because I think people need to learn to think critically and for themselves. Another great reason to have history in history classes.
Don't you think that is another downside of the internet? Because people just, I don't need to remember this, I'll just look it up on the internet. And there's so many choices to that answer when you look it up on the internet. Hey, I'm Ann Eller right here with Vernon Burton. We're going to hear a quick word from our sponsors, and when we come back, I think we're going to talk a little bit about Lincoln and the debates and how he shaped or saw our country being shaped. Don't you go away.
Does this make sense? We buy your gold, diamonds, jewelry, coins, sterling silver at the highest prices, paying extra for fine jewelry and quality, and we're always buying your diamonds and colored stones too. But we sell at the lowest prices, from diamonds to gemstone jewelry to sterling silver pieces and antique and estate jewelry. Always lowest prices for quality jewelry. See us today, Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood, 229-6613.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here. We're with Vernon Burton this afternoon. You know, you wrote a book, The Age of Lincoln. The Age of Lincoln. And why did you write that book, Vernon?
Well, I grew up in 96, and I had two heroes as a child. One was Jesse James, the other Abraham Lincoln. And I think I saw, supposedly Jesse James robbed from the rich and gave the poor, and they both loved their mother. But the more I studied Jesse James, the more I discovered that Jesse James was pretty much a thug, and he didn't give anything to anybody but himself. He was just an old Confederate who really didn't give up and was determined to kill as many Yankees and pretty racist as well. He actually came out of not a poor family at all, but a slave-owning family. Mm-hmm. But the more I studied Lincoln, the more amazed I was. Lincoln truly was born poor. It's not true that he built the log cabin with his own hands. He was born in, but he was born in a log cabin with a dirt floor, and he worked hard. And through hard work, through education, he really made something of himself.
And he failed president. Several times doing things that he did growing up.
That's right. Yeah. He did, and he learned from those. And as I got to look at it, and then I think Lincoln argued that he, in fact, I'm writing a book now on Lincoln in the South. I argue he's a Southerner, which you would think that people would like. But, when I taught Southern history for 34 years at the University of Illinois, I moved back home down here to 96 and discovered people don't like Lincoln very much down here anymore. But I argue
Why
not only
that?
He's the greatest president, well, there's a lot of reasons, I think, but I argue he's the greatest president, also the greatest theologian, I think, of the 19th century, and that he's a Southerner. A lot of it is libertarians really don't like that Lincoln brought in big government, bureaucracy, income tax. And it is true, government just expanded under the war, and of course he uses force to stop the Confederacy, particularly South Carolina, from leaving the Union. But I think it's more the culture wars. When I grew up in 96, people looked at Lincoln as sort of malice toward none. Mm-hmm. And African Americans looked at him as a great emancipator. And now with the culture wars, white Southerners, many of them see him negatively along with the libertarians. And African Americans see him as the embodiment of white racism. He's gone from the great emancipator to the great white honky.
Now, how can that be?
Well, it just happened. Culture. I think I can explain it, but we'd take more time than this.
Okay.
It may change for African Americans. Obama identifies with Lincoln so much. And it's mainly among intellectuals. See, when we looked at slavery, Lincoln looked really good because he really does hate slavery and end slavery. But when you look at race, and with the Civil Rights Movement, historians' interest shifted from, in fact, so much slavery to race and race relations. Well, Lincoln was a white Southerner, and he told racist jokes, used racist words, but he learned and he changed. In fact, today we call politicians who change their mind flip-floppers, and that's a bad word. But I'm glad Lincoln was a flip-flop. When he learned, when he had education, when he met with the South Carolina former slave, the hero who stole the planter from the Confederacy in Charlotte, Robert Small, the Gullah statesman, he learned from him. In fact, he asked Robert Small, he said, why would you risk your life, your children's life, your wife's life, and those other enslaved people when you sail that ship out?
Right.
Under the Confederacy's eyes, they would have hung him if they'd have caught him at all of them. And Smalls gave Lincoln a one-word answer. He said, freedom. And a year later, that's the very word that Lincoln echoes in one of our greatest speeches of all time, the Gettysburg Address, this new birth of freedom that Lincoln talks about. Lincoln, I think, is the greatest president because he redefined what liberty meant, not only in the United States, but for the whole world, in a way that put the United States, in fact, back as the center of where every other country wanted to be. You know, a lot of people don't realize, they say, why didn't Lincoln was criticized because he was slow to get to the Emancipation Proclamation. And everybody asked, you know, Lincoln, why didn't you end slavery? He said, well, I was about preserving the Union. So why didn't he just let South Carolina go? Everybody else, every single other candidate who was seen as more radical than, in fact, Lincoln, said they'd have let South Carolina go. It was just a troublemaker. Let it just go on off. I have a great story from a man, Mr. Maccabee, in Tennessee, when he heard that South Carolina seceded. He said, that's great. I'll raise a regiment. We'll go down and dig a moat around South Carolina, let it float out into the ocean, get rid of those troublemakers. But then after the firing on Fort Sumter, Lincoln's calling of troops, Maccabee did raise a regiment, but it was a regiment for the Confederacy. So it's a complicated story. Yeah. And Lincoln was about preserving the Union. Part of why he preserved the Union was his belief in democracy. And we forget our history. Lincoln knew his history so well. We were talking about civic lessons. He was a great student of politics and the world and what was going on. You know, there'd been the American Revolution, and we inspired revolutions everywhere. The French Revolution, republic spring up there. Mexico is a republic and a democracy. But what we forget is the turn back against democracy. Napoleon comes in, and you have a monarchy. You know, we love the musical Les Miserables, but that celebrates another or tells the story of another failed revolution. All the revolution of 1848 failed. Garibaldi reunites Italy, thinks it's going to be a democracy, goes back to a monarchy. The world's going the other way. Napoleon III, in fact, puts Maximilian on the throne of what had been a democracy in Mexico. So the Confederacy is much more in line with the rest of the world as people have decided that democracy doesn't work. And here's a good example. South Carolina's going to leave the Union, and it was just like Lincoln said, and after South Carolina leaves and they have a Confederacy, then one state will just fall. People can't govern themselves. So he really believed that the only way that someone like himself, poor, could be recognized by their labor, what they did and how hard they worked, that is, the meritocracy was in this republic, and that was part of why he could not let them go.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about a poor man like Lincoln and everything. In today's world, he would not be able to do what he did.
Probably, but, you know, there's opportunities. I'm amazed, you know, neither my mom nor dad finished high school in 96. Hard work is undervalued. But I think there are opportunities for people, particularly with education. That's what we were talking earlier, the importance of education.
But not to become president today or to become a senator or something. You have to rise above, and it takes so much money, which I think is such a shame because it does put a lot of good people out of.
Clinton has a lot of money now.
Yeah.
But he, as a politician, he sort of, you know, went without that much money into the presidency. And things. So there are opportunities, I think, and ways. And, you know, I still think America is the greatest country in the world with the greatest opportunity. That's why we have the problem with the voter. People want to come here because of that opportunity that Lincoln was so determined to preserve.
Now you
and
had
after the Civil War, like, you know, they went to Garibaldi and said, would you like to be commander of the troops in America? And he said, well, is this war about liberty and about freeing the slaves, or is it a war between states? And, oh, it's about preserving you. He says, well, I don't want to get messed up in your domestic squabble. I could care less. But after the Emancipation Proclamation, Garibaldi sent Lincoln a letter and said, you will be go down, you know, as the heir of Jesus Christ. Your name will forever be because, you know, you have freed the slave. But Lincoln went beyond that. What I think he greatly did was to change our concept of liberty and once again inspired the world to move toward democracy.
And how did he do that?
Well, you know, I like to think that Lincoln took what I call our mission statement, the Declaration of Independence, and put it into the Constitution. Before Lincoln and before the freeing of enslaved people and the Emancipation Proclamation, every amendment gave power back to the states. It said what the federal government could not do. Mm-hmm. This is one of the reasons people don't like Lincoln now, because he began the sort of involvement of the federal government into your lives. So with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, instead of those early amendments that said, you know, the federal government can't do this, all rights reserved to the states, it says that you have the right as an individual, personal liberty, to be free. You have the right with the 14th Amendment to be treated equally. In the 15th Amendment, you have the right, and the federal government backs you up to be able to vote. Lincoln had said, if I am to be remembered for anything, it will be for the Emancipation Proclamation. And I think he is remembered for that, but his most greatest contribution is this taking what we think of as positive liberty. In fact, he defined it as positive liberty long before the philosophers like Isaiah Berlin did. He told one of my favorite stories. Do I have time for it?
You do. Let me just say this. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Go ahead, Vernon.
All right. It was, I love this story he wrote back about the shepherd and the sheep and the wolf. And he says the sheep really appreciate and say thank you to the shepherd for protecting them and giving them their liberty from the wolf. But the wolf decries and says the shepherd has in fact denied him his liberty, in fact, to eat and take advantage of the sheep. And then Lincoln added on what he was talking about and said, especially that's true if the sheep is a black sheep. So he was talking about slavery and positive and negative liberty, and that changed the concept of personal liberty and what we mean by it and how it's protected by the Constitution. And I really think that is why, once again, the United States became the beacon of hope to people.
And it should remain the beacon of hope to people.
Yeah, and I have hope. As I said, history and good education, good public education, has got to be essential for democracy.
Absolutely. And probably throw in a little civics and understanding of how this government works.
Exactly.
Well, Vernon Burton, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for coming in today.
Oh, thank you. It's always fun to be here, and thank you for doing such a great job. And this is what Lincoln would say is education's all about, for all the education that you're doing by having politicians and others come and talk a little longer than their 30 seconds that you see in the ads.
Thank you very much, Vernon.
Thank you.
You got me all choked up. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Bye-bye, everybody.